Hi, I'm Lisa Stepak, and you are listening to Brave Space, a platform for honesty and presence where we invite diverse perspectives on how the university and our society can do the work of becoming a truly welcoming environment, not just on paper, but in practice. Today, we are lucky to be speaking with Manisha Sinha, who is the Draper Chair in American History at UConn. She's also the author of The Slave's Cause, A History of Abolition, which won the Frederick Douglass Book Prize a couple years ago. As an Indian American with an academic specialty in the history of U.S. slavery, Sinha has a uniquely informed perspective on many of the issues taking center stage in the U.S. right now. We wanted to speak with her about some of them, in particular about what it means to her to see a Black woman of Indian descent as the vice presidential candidate of a major party in this country.
You wrote in the New York Times the day after Joe Biden announced Kamala Harris as his running mate that you were experiencing his choice as a personal gift. Can you talk to me a little about what that means to you?
Yes, so I had written this op-ed a few weeks before Joe Biden announced his decision in anticipation that he would in fact give me this personal gift. And I sent it to the New York Times and I told them, you know, use it if Kamala Harris is announced as Biden's choice. And if not, you can just trash the op-ed. It so happened that she was chosen and they decided to run my piece. They ran it online initially, but it got so much feedback that they put it in print also. And I guess the reason why I felt so invested in this choice is because I am Indian American and I study African American history. So Kamala Harris's personal origins really spoke to me at all levels, at a personal level, at a professional level. Here was the daughter of Indian and Jamaican immigrants, an Afro-Indian, if you will, American, who is now the nominee for the vice presidency of the United States. She's the first Black woman, the first Indian American woman to ever be chosen as the vice presidential nominee for a major political party. And that in itself was extremely inspiring. It is so important to have a diversity of voices and faces and representation. I think American democracy can deal with a dose of optimism and hope.
Speaking of hope, another thing that you wrote about, I believe in that same piece, is that after Obama was elected, you were able to stop explaining your last name.
Yes. So when I first came to this country in the 1980s, my name, Manisha Sinha, just didn't sound to many people as, you know, the average run-of-the-mill name. People always ask me, how do you pronounce your name? What does it mean? You know, those are the kinds of questions that I got just used to fielding as an immigrant to the United States, someone with a very Indian name. And when Barack Obama became president, as he said, a man with a funny name, I just felt that it really reflected what the United States means to so many different immigrants and so many people from different ethnic and cultural backgrounds. And I remember I actually started writing for the public, for a broader audience, only after he announced his presidential candidacy. There was something about it that I think made me want to kind of reach out to fellow American citizens and talk about my own work in a way that I hadn't earlier. Before that, I wrote academic books and I spoke to academic audiences. But starting in 2007, 2008, I was writing op-eds in the mainstream press. I became invested in politics in a way that I hadn't been even after getting my citizenship under President Bill Clinton.
That's so interesting. I just assumed that you had always done this. I'm wondering what else that election changed for you personally and maybe what it didn't change.
Personally and professionally, I felt that the election was such an important marker for me. I was writing a book on the history of the abolition movement, which eventually became the Slaves' Cause. And I just felt so inspired and compelled to finish that book, I think, because of Barack Obama's presidency. And again, unlike many people in the left, I did not see Barack Obama's election as having ushered in a socialist revolution. You know, I've studied American history. I know presidents are elected in this country and that they work within the political and constitutional parameters that they work in. I saw Obama's election really more as a parallel to Lincoln's election, who was not an abolitionist. He was a moderate anti-slavery politician, but he was able to implement a lot of abolitionist aims while he was elected. And that's how I started writing for the public. I did this piece where I compared Obama to Lincoln. You know, they were both one-time senators. Lincoln was a representative from Illinois, and Hillary Clinton was a senator from New York. She was a lot like Seward, who was contending for the Republican nomination, a seasoned politician against Lincoln. So I did this comparison, and I think I was the first one to make that comparison. And I published that in the Huffington Post, which had just begun as a digital media. And that analogy got picked up. And then I'm reading like 100 other pieces where people were saying the exact same thing. But I will happily lay claim to the fact that I was the first one to make that particular historical analogy.
You say that people have trouble understanding the personal connection you feel to Black Americans and their history of slavery, which of course is your area of academic expertise. Why do you think people have such trouble understanding that connection?
Well, I think many people don't realize that the Black freedom struggle in the United States had a parallel in nationalist and decolonization movements in Asia and Africa, and that activists on both sides of the divide reached out to each other and had a connection. So in the New York Times, I wrote more about the civil rights movement because that is something that most people have heard of and can understand. But if you go back even further to the earlier, you know, 20th century, you have Indian nationalists like Jawaharlal Nehru, who became our first prime minister in India, sort of having a correspondence with W.E.B. Du Bois, the great Black activists and one of the founders of the NAACP. So those connections have always been there. You know, Du Bois definitely wrote about that, about the darker peoples of the globe. And coming to the United States and studying African-American history, the history of slavery, emerging as a historian of slavery abolition and the Civil War, I felt those connections even more strongly because many of the issues that people were trying to fight for were somewhat similar. And yeah, I just think that we should be aware of that. And in a way, Kamala Harris's selection personifies it. You know, there are a lot of people who see in her, as they did with President Obama, a lot of their own aspirations and hopes. I think it becomes important to tease out those historical and political connections. It's not as if those are just natural or they just emerge. In fact, they're the result of political work. They're the result of activists, of civil rights activists, of people fighting in freedom movements throughout the world who have built those connections and who then analyze it and interpret it in a certain way. And that's important.
You clearly were very much aware of U.S. politics from an early age, even in India. And I'm wondering if you at that time could imagine somebody like Kamala Harris being the vice presidential candidate for one of the major parties?
Well, you know, growing up in India, I didn't even think I would come to the United States. I grew up in an average middle-class family. My father was quite a bit of an intellectual, a historian, and so are my sisters, and we are all historians. And I grew up in an India where, for the better part of my life, the prime minister was a woman, Indira Gandhi. So it didn't seem to me that there was something unusual about women being in power. And in India, you know, women are not exactly equal to men. It's a very hierarchical society, both in terms of gender and class. But just having a woman prime minister, I think for a lot of girls in India meant, you know, this is something that women could do. I remember I won a writing competition when I was in high school, and it was an all India competition. It was called the Shankar competition, and Prime Minister Indira Gandhi gave out the awards, and I actually got to meet her and like, shake her hands and receive that certificate from her. And I was thrilled. So I wouldn't imagine that I would have been in the United States or studying American history and that I would live to see an Indian American nominated for the vice presidency of the United States. I certainly didn't feel that way when I finally did come to the US in the 1980s. It was a very conservative time. And, you know, I remember just taking part in all these rallies against apartheid because at that time, the Reagan administration was supporting the apartheid regime in South Africa. I remember all my American friends always telling me and my husband, who is German, to sort of stand at the back of the rallies, because if we got arrested, we could be deported. We just had student visas. We were not citizens at that point. So no, even in the 80s, when I came here, I couldn't imagine that we would have had an African-American man as the president of the United States or a Black woman as a vice presidential nominee.
You're talking about when you first came and not long after that you started teaching. And I'm wondering how you've seen students change in that period of time.
And that's a great question. I think in general, this is what gives me hope and optimism. Even as I have grown older, my students remain the same age, which is kind of interesting. And they have different views and they've become more progressive. And I think it kind of keeps me young and on my toes too. And I like that. I like interacting with young people in the United States because they've just grown up without a lot of the kind of racial baggage that their parents have had. Now, this might be a bit Pollyannish because clearly there are lots of people who may not feel the same, but I think maybe the universe just bent towards justice because they are definitely far more liberal than their parents and grandparents.
I hope the universe is bending toward justice. Tell me, in your opinion, what you see as things UConn is doing well when it comes to diversity, equity, inclusion, and what do you think we need to do better?
UConn, on the whole, I think has done a better job perhaps than most of the institutions I have known and been affiliated with. Let's put it that way. UMass, where I taught for 20 years, also was pretty good. These public institutions are doing better than they did. They seem to understand that the goal of higher education is education and not to make profits, which a lot of the private universities seem to be more concerned about their endowments and making money and tuition. Many of these public universities began actually during the Reconstruction era as land grant universities, as public universities to serve, you know, the public good, the common good. I think academic institutions in general in the US and institutions of higher learning are very good at the form of being liberal and diverse and having the right policies. We are lacking with substance. And the reason why we are sometimes lacking substance is not so much the fault of the institutions themselves as the fact that they are a reflection of broader society. And since American society has grown more and more unequal, with fewer and fewer people having access to higher education, and especially for communities of color, it becomes very difficult to play catch up at that level. If communities have been deprived of good schools and educations right from the start, you know, how do you play catch up at the university level? And I see a lot of American institutions trying to do that, play that catch up game. And even then, they're not completely successful because we are not that diverse. We are still not that diverse, even though we have more women in higher education, we have more people of color. But many times I find myself in a room of Civil War historians where I am the only non-white woman, right? Whether it's a panel or et cetera. And it doesn't faze me. I mean, it doesn't bother me. I just go ahead because I'm sort of used to it. But many of my younger students, it bothers them, you know, it bothers them that they are always asked to represent in all white spaces or all male spaces. I think we can just do a better job with real substantial things rather than just having the form that, oh, we believe in this, or just like paying lip service to something. Because I think academia is very good at paying lip service to diversity, but it's really the hard work of having more and more representation. And again, we can't do it alone. And that's why it's so important for a broader public. I don't have to just teach my students. I want to write for the average American citizen, the person walking on the road. Do you know that in the 19th century, this happened and this has a resonance to why things are today this way and what we are fighting for? Because many times I think history, American history especially, is told in very simplistic, mythic ways, one that prevents, I think, American citizens from being good citizens, from being good, virtuous citizens in the Republican sense of having political virtue, of being able to think of the common good before your individual self-interest.
We're calling the series Brave Space, and I'm wondering if you could share with me somebody you admire as a model for bravery.
Well, I'm a great admirer of Mahatma Gandhi, who led India's freedom struggle, and who, of course, inspired Nelson Mandela, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., his whole idea of nonviolent resistance, and this idea that if you behave the way your enemy does, you debase yourself too. You know, that an eye for an eye makes the world blind. I was actually asked in one of the monument debates on whether Gandhi's statue should come down because he had expressed some sort of ethnocentric, racialist ideas when he was in South Africa against Black Africans. And the only answer I had was what Nelson Mandela gave, which was to say, let's judge the man in his entirety, and also the fact that we should put those statements in context with his larger project of building solidarities with people of color all over the world.